Hello, this is Angela Ewing with KCIAW, Curry Coast Community Radio. Storytime, 9 o'clock horses, episode 11. Hildreth Sanitarium in Brighton faced the sea. Glass-enclosed verandas had been built onto the front of the Georgian mansion so that patients could sit in comfort on the front veranda and face the lovely views of the beach across the boulevard. My room was overlooking the grounds at the side of the house, where lawns and rose beds were carefully tended. My roommate, Sheila, a delicate girl of 23, lived in Birmingham and had been at the sanitarium a month. It didn't take long before we were chatting comfortably with each other. "Is that your fiancé you're with in the photograph?" Sheila asked. "Yes, it was taken about a year ago." "Is he tall?" "Well, much taller than me anyway. He's about 6 feet. He's such a lovely man. Brown eyes and hair and a nice body." "Oh, really?" Sheila giggled. I could feel myself blushing. "Hussy," Sheila said. I threw a pillow at her. She tried to laugh but coughed instead. Just a reminder of where I was. When they moved me to another wing facing the ocean, visitors were allowed. I missed Sheila because she was still in the other part of the sanitarium. I had been there for 8 weeks and was getting better, they said. My father came with Aunt Olive. That was a real surprise. My friend Maggie, whom I'd known since high school, was on holiday in Brighton, and we spent an hour reminiscing about old times and other girls we'd known at Folville School. Colin arrived a few days later with a big bunch of my favourite flowers he'd actually bought from Uncle Walter. I bawled. "Hey, lass," he said, "what is it? I thought you loved freesias." "I do," I wept, "but, you know, Aunt Dorothy died, and well, I think of her when I smell these. I'm just sad, that's all." "Well, I came at the right time to cheer you up then." He sat on the bed, handed me a big fancy box. I knew what it was by the label on the lid. CNA Modes. We had been shopping together weeks ago. I had tried on a lovely blue wool suit with a little fur collar. I told him 6 guineas was far too expensive, but now I was delighted with the gift and could imagine myself in it with the white blouse he'd chosen. He showed me the ticket to New York. It was dated March the 27th, 1962. I held it in my hands and studied every word. I wondered how long it would be before I held a ticket with my name on it. When one of the nurses brought us a cup of tea, we sat out on the glass-enclosed veranda overlooking the sea. In my mind, I imagined an envelope opened and I viewed the ticket. My name was on it. Through the open window, we could hear the waves pounding on the shingle beach. Thin winter sun gave little warmth through the glass, and I felt cold, even though Colin had pulled a thick blanket around me. "They should have let you stay in an inside room on a day like today," he said. No, I said, "the idea is to have fresh air all the time. Last week I slept on the outside porch. It's part of the treatment." "You're so pale, lass. Are you all right? You are getting better, aren't you?" I didn't tell him I had developed a kind of cough that I hadn't had before, and the doctor had informed me sometimes TB got worse before it got better. "Oh, yes," I said, "I'll be out really soon. I'm just sorry I can't come to the airport with you to see you off, Colin." I wasn't just sorry, I was heartbroken. On the day he left, I felt as though it was the end of the world. Fears rose above me like dark clouds. What if the plane crashed? What if he hated New York? What if he found someone else before I got there? At first, letters came regularly from New York. Colin described the busy streets with the skyscrapers that reached up and up, leaving a tiny space of blue in between. He wrote about his apartment and his office in Manhattan and the people he'd met at work. After a while, I felt I knew all the places he visited. When he sent me a photograph of himself leaning against a car, a streak of fear ran through me. Things were escalating too fast without me being there. The apartment, now the car. I should have been part of that. He'd written a note underneath the photo of the car. It's red and old, but it runs well. Then a letter. You'll love it here, even though it's hot and humid now. He wrote he didn't take baths anymore. Everyone has a shower in the States, he said. I tried to imagine what a shower was like. No more weekly baths in the old portable bathtub set up on Friday night in the kitchen where it was warm. I remember I was usually that last one in the same water after my sister and brother. It wasn't until I was a senior in school that we had bathroom installed with hot running water separated from the small room, the WC, in England, or, as we called it, the loo. The word loo comes from the French word garde-loo, which means watch out for the water. In medieval times in England, chamber pots were tipped out of the bedroom windows and the maid or someone would shout out the window, garde-loo. Probably it sounded like guard the loo if you were out on the street down below. It struck me rather strange that my mother still used the chamber pot, even though the toilet was now upstairs, close to her room. In Hildreth Sanitarium, two more months rolled by in a series of boredom and reading of books. It was July when I finally was told I could leave. The roses in the garden were in full bloom. The air was scented with flowers and salt from the sea. A nurse who came to my room as I was packing announced that the hole in my lung was calcifying, but I would still need the streptomycin injections that would be administered by my own doctor when I got home. My father had offered to come to Brighton to accompany me back home. I told him no. I had to go to London to the American consulate to show them my X-rays. It was imperative, I thought, that they knew I was well again and able to go to the States. It was quite simple now, it seemed to me. All my worries were over, and I would soon be flying over the Atlantic. At least, that's what I thought as I made my way to London on the short train ride from Brighton. I wore my new blue suit and the white blouse. I had convinced one of the nurses to help me touch up the dark roots of my hair. I liked being blonde. All I had to carry with me was a small overnight bag. I felt good, full of hope. Nothing could stop me from being with Colin now. I felt confident as I walked up the steps of the beautiful white building of the American consulate with the huge pillars and the eagle in gold poised high above the entrance. I was shown into a large room with a portrait of the president, J.F. Kennedy. I was studying photographs of past American presidents adorning the walls when a young man in a dark suit and tie came into the room and introduced himself as Jason. I handed him my medical reports and a large manila envelope with my X-rays. An hour passed before he finally reappeared to lead me down a long corridor to a small office where a tall man with dark-rimmed glasses sat behind an enormous desk. The name, Elliot Crawford, was stenciled in gold on a sign on his desk. I recognized my file open in front of him. He looked up and smiled. "It's good news, young lady," he said. I was conscious of his American accent. "I've read your report, and I've had our medical advisor look at your X-rays. I'll make sure you have all the copies of these reports before you leave here today." "Now," he said, motioning me to take a seat. "Now we have to get you a sponsor." I must have looked confused, because he took his glasses off and carefully placed them on the table. His eyes never left me as he said, "You do know that anyone applying for a green card needs a sponsor, such as verified employment, right?" I took a deep breath. "My fiancé Colin Hadley is already there in New York and he will sponsor me." "Is he a citizen?" "No, not yet, but he will be soon. He works for Bell Telephone Company." I see. Well, it's not as simple as that. For one thing, he has to be a citizen before he can sponsor you. That means he has to be there for 3 years. Also, you are still undergoing treatment for a communicable disease, which means you will have to have someone to take full responsibility for you and sign an affidavit to that effect. Well, I said again, trying to remain calm, how can I find someone to sponsor me if I don't know anyone there? The man put his glasses back on and wrote something on a sheet of paper. Your best bet is to work for a family in America. There are many wealthy folks who are willing to hire a girl as an au pair or nanny and be the responsible party. You need someone to sign an affidavit that you will not become a ward of the state. Do you understand? He obviously thought I was a little dim, and I felt foolish when he leaned forward over his large desk to hand me a paper with a letterhead, United States Consulate, London, England. Here is the name and address and the phone number of an agency in Hertford, he said as he closed the file on his desk. I wanted to correct him. Hartford, not Hertford. I wanted to say that, but I didn't. This particular nanny agency hires all sorts of families in the United States. I'm afraid that's about your only choice. My job, I said, suddenly feeling desperate. My boss said he would arrange for me to work in New York. What papers would I need for him to do that? Mr. Compton sighed and leaned his elbows on the table. I want you to listen carefully, Miss Norton. I know you're eager to join your fiancé in the States. However, because of your disease, you need a sponsor or an employer who, as I've said before, is willing to sign an affidavit that you will be cared for should tuberculosis appear, so that you will not become a ward of the state. Could have been your husband, but you're not married, and in any case, he hasn't been there 3 years. So that is not applicable in your case. Well, what can I do? I could feel the tears pricking my eyes. I have to get there soon. Mr. Compton closed the file. Call the agency in Hertford. I cannot help you further. I'm sorry. The young man in the suit was already at the door waiting to show me out. I turned to Mr. Crawford with an idea that suddenly presented itself in my mind. I can go as a visitor. Mr. Crawford looked up, a puzzled expression on his face. I wouldn't allow that in your present condition. In 3 years, you can apply for a visitor's visa. By then, I suspect you will be totally cured. Now I had to tell my parents I couldn't go to the States right away as planned. I had been so sure, so adamant in the face of their doubt. I fled back to Foxby, to Aunt Olive, and tore up the paper Mr. Compton had given me with the address and phone number of the agency for nannies abroad. I didn't want to be an au pair. That was the last thing on my mind. On the way back to Foxby, sitting on the bus, I decided Colin would have to come back to England. That was obviously the answer. Now I felt a bit better. Aunt Olive, unmarried and a retired teacher, rarely showed emotion to me, but she saw my face and came to hug me. Are you still not well, dear? You look so thin. No, I'm fine. It's just that... I told her the tale of my day at the consulate and the terrible news that I could not go to the States without a sponsor. Oh, dear, she said. She studied me for a moment. Surely England is not such a bad place to live, is it? You can go later. America will still be there. But it's not what we planned, I said. I was ready to start crying again. Your father rang me this afternoon, she said. She went into the kitchen. I heard her fill the kettle. He's concerned about you. You were supposed to call him when you got back. I know. I can't tell him yet. It's too embarrassing. I could feel the tears sliding down my cheeks. Nonsense, she said. I had finally stopped crying when she came into the living room with the tea tray. She set it on the side table. You know, there's a very large parcel in the hall that came from Colin yesterday. If you look at the postmark, you'll notice it took 6 weeks to get here. I ran into the hall and brought the package back into the living room. I set it on the floor and just stared at it. Then I took it up to my bedroom. I shook it to see if it rattled. It was all so carefully wrapped, the ends folded neatly and evenly. Inside, tissue paper lined a pink box. I gasped when I lifted out a negligee, pale pink silk, with lace trim and a nightdress to match. I had never seen anything so beautiful. I laid it on the bed and stared at it before I noticed the folded sheet of paper in the bottom of the box. Darling, I saw this in Saks. I couldn't resist buying it, and it will pack easily so you can wear it for me very soon. Tell that boss of yours to get off his behind and get the ball rolling. I need you here. I love you, and I'm looking forward to seeing you very soon. I've moved into a bigger apartment with air conditioning. When you write, use the new address. Love, Colin. Aunt Olive came into the bedroom. What did Colin send you? Oh, she said, looking at the nightdress and the negligee. That is lovely. How am I going to tell him I can't go? I whispered. I looked out of the window at the peaceful fields and the grazing sheep in the stillness of evening. England would not be so bad a place to live after all. A house in the country would be nice, here in Foxby with Colin. Those thoughts consoled me for a moment before the dread of having to tell Colin. How was I going to approach him about his return? Or on the other hand, maybe he wouldn't mind a bit. I'm going to have to tell him that he has to come home. That's all there is to it, I said to Olive. This time I felt a little more confident. It was true. England was not that bad. You have been listening to Storytime, 9 o'clock Horses, Episode 11. Tune in next week for Episode 12. Thank you for listening.
If you enjoyed this program and want to hear more like it, consider supporting Curry Coast Community Radio and help us get on the air. For more information, go to our website, kciw.org. Thank you for listening.